I don't know his name, and I don't know that anybody's ever reported it, but it's pretty likely that you've seen the picture on the front of your bulletin in the last few weeks. It's of an ER doctor in Southern California on March the 18th that an EMT snapped a picture of about an hour after that same EMT had brought a 19-year-old into the ER that doctor had worked on, and after several hours, lost. And in the wake of that 19-year-old's death, that ER doctor walked out into the parking lot and bent down there before that wall and wept uncontrollably. He'd lost someone else. Now, it's a silly question even to ask, but why does he weep? ER doctors see this kind of thing all the time, right? It's part of their life. It's their vocation. And yet, you don't have to be a doctor to realize that even in that reality, it doesn't mitigate the pain of death. There is obviously great anguish in his heart that here's somebody at the beginning of their life practically who has now been snuffed out, and there's not a thing he can do about it. And there's probably a great deal of frustration, if not anger, in his heart that for all of his training and for all of this technology that is at his disposal, none of that could stop this. That even with all of that, sometimes, oftentimes, death prevails and there's not a thing he can do about it. And that's why he's bent down at this wall, losing himself in tears at the reality of one more death. Another doctor who saw this picture wrote an anonymous comment on some blog post, and that quote is on the front of your bulletin. And that doctor said, by his own experience, "Yesterday, one of my 17-month-old patients died. I was in the bathroom crying in private between patients several times yesterday. I've cried in stairwells and hallways. It eats at you. Life is very fragile. And the pain of losing those we are trying to help becomes a scar that doesn't go away. It has shaped who I am as a person." The very tears that doctor and every doctor who loses somebody sheds reveals what is most true to them, what they most believe. But at least according to this doctor's testimony, that experience and their vocation actually shapes their identity. It forms it. For this series during Lent, we've been considering the question of identity. We've been considering Jesus' identity, and we've also been considering our identity. And this morning, we're going to look at one more passage, one more I am statement of Jesus, one of those self-attestations of who he is that helps us get a fuller picture of his entire profile. But as we do so, we're also going to get a picture of who we're to be. Because look, brothers and sisters, you don't have to be a doctor, although there are doctors in our midst today, to realize this truth. There are going to be moments in your life where you're going to be brought to your knees. And the question that we all have to ask ourselves is this: what are you going to do with what brings you to your knees? This day has its own answer to that question. Easter has its own answer. And in the passage we're going to read, we're going to see how Jesus answers that question by three things he does. We're going to find out what he means to prove to us. We're going to consider what he means to prompt in us. We're going to consider what he means to provide for us. What does he mean to prove to us? What does he mean to prompt in us? And what is he out to provide for us? It's a long passage. We're in John chapter 11, starting in verse 1. Would you stand as we read? John chapter 11, starting in verse 1. "Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, 'Lord, he whom you love is ill.' But when Jesus heard it, he said, 'This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it.' Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. And then after this, he said to the disciples, 'Let's go to Judea again.' The disciples said to him, 'Rabbi, The Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and you want to go there again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he doesn't stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light's not in him. After saying these things, he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he'll recover. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he meant taking rest and sleep. And then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died. And for your sake, I'm glad that I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him. So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been dead in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off. And many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Mary heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him. But Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you're the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, the teacher's here. He's calling for you. And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, where have you laid him? And they said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. So the Jews said, see how he loved him? But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying? And then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. And Jesus said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, by this time there'll be an odor. He's been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? And so they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And the man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips and his face wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said to him, unbind him, let him go. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Jesus did not walk around to listen to the own sound of his voice. He was out to prove something. Throughout the series that we've had here in John's account, we've been saying that John had a bigger point to writing his account more than just sort of telling us about Jesus' life. His larger point is to prove something to us about Jesus. That's John's point because that was Jesus' point. He's not just talking to talk. What Jesus said and did was out to make a point, to prove that point so that we would believe that point, so that we would believe him. And what Jesus is out to prove is what John says in John 21, that he's the Christ, that he's the Son of the living God. And in first century Palestinian terms, those are phrases that are totally accessible, totally understandable. They don't need unpacking. To us, not so much. They're somewhat familiar. We don't feel the full weight, but we get it. We know that Christ in the Greek literally means somebody who's been anointed, who's been endowed with a special purpose and a power. We also know that this phrase, in some form or fashion, Son of God, refers to some sort of unparalleled identification and intimacy with God, whom Jesus calls his Father. But if you want to get down to brass tacks about what it means to believe that Jesus is the Christ, that he's the Son of God, then what you're talking about is this. You're talking about believing that Jesus is eminently and absolutely trustworthy. It's not just a title. It's a way of seeing him. That he holds preeminence in his authority, but also in his approachability. And so this whole passage, the whole gospel account, is out to encourage belief that he's trustworthy. Trustworthiness that should lead us to want to follow him through hell and high water. And in this passage, he's out to prove he's trustworthy in essentially three ways. Trustworthy first, because he is utterly united to God, whom he knows as Father. The whole passage, as you can see, takes place in the passage in the context of a crisis. A friend to Jesus named Lazarus is dying. Lazarus' sisters send word to him, please come, please do what you've always done, please bring your healing. And when Jesus hears of his friend's sickness, he does what no friend of any sick person ever has done. He sits there. Years ago, my oldest boy falls off his bunk bed, hits his head on the back of the bed on the way down. Daddy! Run upstairs. He's bleeding profusely. I learned in that moment, or actually after that moment, that any kind of cut to the head is like profuse bleeding. In that moment, I'm thinking, this is a different kind of bleed. I'm not calling the wife. I'm not pulling out the Boy Scout handbook. I'm calling 911. And I do. And I say, please send an ambulance, because this looks different. If the 911 dispatcher says to me, got it, we'll be there in 2 days. That dispatcher is fired within the next day, and I'm considering her having a brain bleed, right? If we want to take the metaphor, let's really closely. If Seamus calls to me from upstairs and say, Daddy, I'm bleeding from the back of my head. And I say to him, okay, honey, it's almost halftime in the Final Four. I'll be there in a minute. That's nuts. Whatever it is, it's not love. But when Jesus hears of the sickness of Lazarus, the one whom he loves, whom he calls his friend, what does he do? He hangs back. Verse 5. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister Lazarus, so when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place he was. Funny syntax there. He loves his siblings, so you'd think what he'd do was drop what he was doing. Nope. I'm going to sit tight. Is that love? Yes. Here's why. What he says in verse 4, Jesus says, this illness does not lead to death. It's for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now, we'll get to what it means there when he says that this doesn't lead to death, because we all know he died. But for now, just notice that what Jesus believes and why he's acting as he does. He's saying that this moment is meant to do something. It's meant to prove something, that God is worthy of all glory and that Jesus comes both as part of and in pursuit of that glory. Just before he raises Lazarus from the dead, in verse 40, he says, "Didn't I tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" What drives everything that Jesus says and does is his unmitigated, unapologetic submission to God, his Father. That's why he holds back 2 days. Brothers and sisters, sometimes something has to fall apart for us to know that there's a restoration available to us that we did not think was possible. That's why he pauses. That's also why Jesus walks back into danger. The disciples, when they hear from him, hey, we're going back to Judea, they look at him like he's got two heads. Jesus, Rabbi, they were just trying to kill you, and now you want to walk back into that conflagration? And then Jesus has this rather enigmatic kind of phrase there in verse 9 and 10 about walking while it's still daylight. What that whole enigmatic phrase is getting at is this. It's, as one commentator put it, it's this. Just as daylight means safe walking, God's will is even clearer than daylight, and the clear will of God more than cancels out other dangers. Jesus saying, I'm very clear on what God wants. I'm not worried about what you think might happen. And so he goes, because he gets it, because he gets his Father. Whatever might seek to thwart that will is of no concern to him. That's why Jesus is virtually indefatigable and virtually unmovable. He's out to prove his trustworthiness by his utter confidence in God. But he's also out to prove his trustworthiness because he is also manifestly loving. Lazarus is called Jesus' friend. We've already heard how Jesus loved Lazarus and his two sisters, and what he does for Lazarus in bringing him back to life, that's clear evidence of love. You love somebody, you can do that, that's love, right? But what is the most poignant and powerful proof of the love of Jesus? It's his tears. And more than that, the whole complex of emotions that are compressed into those few moments. It says in verse 33, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And then famously in verse 35, it says, Jesus wept. Now again, it's another silly question to ask, but why was he weeping? If he knew that Lazarus was about to rise again, why would he be crying? Why wouldn't he just be saying, oh, get over it, it's going to be great? He's weeping. The words that refer to his emotional state speak of two things at least. The Greek word for his crying is different from the kinds of weeping that Lazarus' sisters are doing. Theirs is more of a loud lament. The Greek word here refers more to a quiet grieving, an intimate grieving. But coupled to his grieving, to his weeping, is a kind of indignation, a feeling of hostility to the way things are. It's the same word that Jesus uses to describe, it's used to describe Jesus in reacting to the betrayal of Judas. It's the same word that is used to describe how the disciples felt about their teacher's imminent death. Greatly troubled. But brothers and sisters, it's probably the same emotional state as what happened in Boston last week. The jurors in the Boston bomber case listened to final arguments from the prosecution of the alleged bomber. And in those closing arguments, they were shown images of the broken and bloody bodies of the loves that suffered from that massacre. And the jury, it was said, was moved to tears. And brothers and sisters, it is not a far cry to imagine that they might have been moved to a little indignation, a little fury over the very madness of what they were witnessing. I think what that jury felt was not too far off from what provoked Jesus to this emotional state. These tears were for his friend. But I would dare say that they were more so for the way things were, the way things are, the very existence and literal and figurative stench of death. And so when the onlookers say, in view of his tears, see how he loved him, it's true. But folks, in the full range of his emotions, would you just see how he loved us too? Of course there's anger and anguish in those tears, but there's also love. All you have to do is look at this picture. You can't tell me that that ER doctor's weeping wasn't proof that in some sense he was motivated in love for that patient whose name he might not have even known until he pronounced her dead. There's love there. Love in those tears, love in that exasperation that life is fragile. When you look at that ER doctor, you are looking at Jesus. And when you look at Jesus, you are seeing his love, unquestionably, period. He proves that trustworthiness by his utter condescension before God. He proves his trustworthiness by his manifest loving actions. But thirdly, he proves that trustworthiness because he is entirely powerful over death itself. Lazarus dies, the sisters show up one by one in their own way, and they petition Jesus, and they voice virtually the same complaint. If you had been here, you wouldn't have died. And when Martha follows up her complaint, in the same breath, she reaffirms her trust in him. She says, you know, whatever you ask God, God is going to do. I know that. And Jesus says, your brother's going to rise again. And she says, sort of in the concession, I know he'll rise again someday. I know about this resurrection. That was sort of the understanding in the first century in some strands of Judaic thought, that there would be a resurrection, and she believed that. And then Jesus says, it's better than that. I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Brothers and sisters, I bet those words run off you like water off a duck's back, because you've heard it so often. They probably do for me. And yet if we just sat with those for the rest of the afternoon, do you realize how much everything would change in your heart? Just to think about that reality? He is making the most startling promise that anybody has ever made, that trusting in him, that means even when you die, death's not the end. And that even should your body die, the soul endures. That's his promise. It's not a metaphor. It either is true or it is not, but it's not a metaphor. He has made astonishing claims about himself throughout this account, but to back this one up, he raises Lazarus from the dead. That's the story. If you want to say it's an embellishment, you're entitled to that opinion, but you will have to come up with a good case for why it might be. He does what they could never imagine anyone could, to prove himself worthy of trust that nobody else deserves. All of that, his submission to God, his self-evident love, his power over death, that is all out to prove that Jesus is precisely who he said he was. That's what he's out to prove in us. But he's not just out to prove something. He's out to prompt something in us. Believing in what he's trying to prove doesn't create this sort of, okay, I believe it. Something happens in you and in me when we get that, when we trust that. And if you want to make it as simple as possible about what Jesus is out to prompt in us, the simple answer is this. He's out to prompt faith. Faith that has a focus. It's not generic. It's not this general optimism. It's a faith that's focused on him. When you're in the airplane and the turbulence happens, you know what I do? I look at the stewardess for the right reasons. I look at the stewardess to make sure everything is fine. If she doesn't look worried, it's all good. I'm not worried. We look at Jesus. He's our focus. But the kind of faith with focus on him, brothers and sisters, if we learn anything from this text, this faith inevitably lives in flux. Now, maybe you're surprised for me to hear me say that, that faith lives in flux. Like, it's like walking in, sometimes you're in a room that feels very warm, and then you walk into another room and it feels kind of cold. That's sort of the life of faith from time to time, I think. Just look at the sisters for evidence of how the life of faith is faith in flux. They call to him for help. Okay, that's faith, right? But then they complain to him that he didn't show up in time. Their faith has sort of diminished. But then Martha affirms, whatever you ask God, God will give it. That's faith. And then when Jesus says, roll away the stone, and Martha says, there's going to be an odor. Well, wherever that faith was, just kind of like evacuated. Faith rises and falls within the same episode, within a matter of minutes. Now, Jesus certainly does complain to his disciples from time to time. He says, oh, ye of little faith. And some say part of his anguish in this text is that no one really seems to be trusting him fully. But even if his indignation derives in part of the disappointment on their lack of faith, he doesn't ever give them over in the midst of their faith in flux. He doesn't say, I'm done. You can't trust, I'm out. That's not his testimony. He's out to prompt faith in us, even if it lives in flux as it seeks to focus on him. And that faith takes shape in a few domains that you and I will always live in. This faith that he means to prompt in us has an effect on how we pray prayers. What Lazarus' sisters teach us is that you and I may go to Jesus with whatever affliction you have upon you, small or large, inconsequential or consequential, depending on your point of view. In their need, they sought him early, often, and to his face. God may use any manner of conventional means to effect a remedy, even an ER doctor. But he also may use inexplicable means too. The kind that even an ER doctor can't explain. And there are things that ER doctors, some things they can't explain. F.D. Bruner says, it is always enough and appropriate simply to share our deepest problem with him. If you've forgotten that, let me remind you about what faith looks like. The sisters teach us that faith prays and about anything. They also say that what they teach us is about prayer is that you can go to Jesus even with your disappointments and confusion with him. Jesus doesn't bristle at what some people might have thought was impertinence on these sisters' part to say to him, if you had been here, this wouldn't have happened. And in that moment, their pain was fresh and their prayer was honest. And Jesus didn't admonish them for it. We've said this before, brothers and sisters, if you're ever worried about saying to God, why did you do this? He's heard worse. He can take your bewilderment. So be bewildered before him. He can take your broken, unhinged prayers. They teach us that. And when it comes to prayer, their story also teaches that Jesus' refusal to act at what seems like a totally appropriate moment for him to act, that is no indication that he is absent, aloof, or indifferent. He was present, just not in the way they thought. He didn't fail them. He just didn't act in a way that they assumed he would, and that's a big difference. He means to prompt in us prayers. That's what this faith looks like. But he also means to prompt faith in us in how we live our life. What do I mean? This passage is about death, right? And we're going to get to that in a moment. But it's as much about how we to live before we die. The faith that he prompts in us changes the way we think of how to use our life. You know, there's this whole idea about the bucket list, right? The conventional wisdom about the bucket list is it refers to all those things that we'd like to see and do and experience before we die. And on its face, you know, it's not problematic. Lots of things to enjoy. You might even want to catalog it. That's fine. But conventionally speaking, do you realize that in some ways it's premised upon a particular idea? The bucket list, as most people think about it, is premised on the idea that this is all there is. And this is as good as it gets, so you better get all you can. Because like Ferris Bueller put it, life moves pretty fast. If you don't watch out, you might miss it. You know how haunting that idea can be? Do you know how motivating that idea can be? The faith that Jesus means to prompt in us is going to shift the way we think about bucket lists. There is a lot to enjoy here. There is a lot to celebrate and experience. There is innumerable ways in which we might delight in this earth so as to live gratefully, but also with deference to others. But given what Jesus has done for Lazarus and what Jesus promises to us, then brothers and sisters, this is in fact not all there is. This is in fact not as good as it gets. This world is shining in innumerable ways, but it's not all, and it's not even the best. And that's why I put on the front of your bulletin what C.S. Lewis said in some essay. He said, there are far, far better things ahead than anything we leave behind. That's a matter of faith, brothers and sisters, and it's this story that will confront your faith in the opposite direction. The faith he means to prompt in us means living with a wider gaze at what will outlast everything that's here, namely the soul that's worth as much consideration as the body, but also the new heavens and the new earth, a renewed world worthy of due consideration now. That's how this kind of faith is meant to emerge in us, how to be prompted in us. We think of the bucket list differently when we live with faith. But the life we live also changes when we think about the risks that we're willing to take. And we kind of brought this up in last week's sermon. When it comes to risk, you and I are always out to manage it and minimize it. We don't want to do anything that might cause us harm. And obviously, there's some wisdom in that, right? But if you just listen for what Thomas says, he makes this very cameo appearance in verse 16, right? Jesus says, we're going to Judea, right? The disciples say, don't do that. And Jesus says, relax, in so many words. And then Thomas says in verse 16, let's go that we may die with him. Which, if you know Thomas's story, you know that's full of irony, right? Full of faith. Let's go. Bravado, right? And then what happens after Jesus is resurrected? He's saying, yeah, right. I'm going to have to see it to believe it. I'm going to have to bump my finger in his wound. And Jesus says, I'll do you better. I'll let you. But in this moment, even when Thomas is put forth in a way that later will go, where's the bravado now, Thomas? He offers us a glimpse of the kind of faith that Jesus means to prompt in us. The faith that might actually believe that sacrificing for Jesus, even dying for him, might be better than living without him. It's a different kind of faith. It's a different kind of life. There's a commentator named Hoskins who said, keep company with Jesus even though he does advance toward danger and death. That's the kind of faith he's meaning to prompt in us, in me, in you. He means to prompt different prayers in us. He means to prompt a different life in us. But brothers and sisters, if there's anything he means to prompt in us, he's meaning to prompt faith in the face of death. You and I know what most attends death: grief and fear. By Jesus' own tears, we can say without hesitation that faith in him does not make grief invalid. He wept. He was right to grieve over the death of a friend. Some say in part, it might be possible that part of his grieving was grieving in advance for the own death that he was going to be walking into. There's at least five or six of us in this room who've buried a parent in the last 6 months. I dare say part of our grief is realizing that we're going to face the death too, and that the only thing that separates us from it is time. Grief is not the absence of faith. We weep with faith. We weep with those who weep, with faith for them, that we might hold their hand, reminding them that there's hope. But inconsolable grief, the grief that refuses to even entertain the thought of hope or of joy again, that's despair. But brothers and sisters, that's as much an expression of faith as its opposite. You have to have faith in the idea that there is no hope. There's no way to prove that. Given what Jesus has sought to prove, given what Jesus has shown and done in Lazarus and himself, given that, inconsolable grief is based on a promise that cannot be proven any more than the resurrection can. And so there's a place for grief in faith, but grief that grieves with, not without, hope. But attached to our grief is that other thing that we face when we think about death, and that's fear. It's what the author of Hebrews spoke of in our assurance of pardon today. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject. Death engenders fear. Fear of what it will feel like to die, fear of who we leave behind and what we leave behind, fear of the ultimate form of letting go. It naturally accompanies death, but faith in Jesus tempers that fear. Surely he feared what we would feel. Surely he feared what he would feel. You can't understand the experience of his in the garden unless you understand that fear is part of what drove him to tears like drops of blood. But while faith in him won't necessarily obliterate that fear, it will moderate it. And while we're talking about fear, Brothers and sisters, I would dare say that in the experience of death, you know where the fear of death really reigns? It reigns a lot longer, a long time before you're even on your deathbed. Fear reigns when we fear about failing life, failing to find it, or master it, or live it, or as they say, live it to the full. We are Private Ryan at the end of Spielberg's film, when the aged man, looking over the graves of those who risked their lives to die for him, looks to his wife and says, "Did I lead a good life?" It's his terror. And in another Spielberg film at the end of Schindler's List, when Schindler is about to escape into the night, he comes to the sobering realization that he cries out in lament, thinking, "I could have done more. I could have saved more Jews." And he actually crumples before those he had sought to save. Fear reigns in death because we're afraid that we're going to fail to live. But we feel that fear because we feel that there's some sort of standard out there, some sort of benchmark that will just tell us, yes, you lived a full life. To which I ask you, who defines what full is? As George Herbert put it, life is half spent before we know what it is. And he also said, we leave more to do when we die than when we have done. We could have all lived life differently. We could have all done more to think we would have made us having thought we did enough. But brothers and sisters, there is no life that will go on without some regret at its end. And that is why the gospel comes to us and answers that fear in a profound and necessary way. It is Jesus who comes to us and says, it is not the measure of your living that esteems you with the universe. It is the measure of his living that esteems you with God. The fact that God sends his only Son in order to die for sin is evidence that we are powerless to do anything, to live on our own light or our own strength, to make our lives worthy of something. That doesn't mean we become passive supplicants. It just means that we end up not turning all of our pursuits into one big futile effort to prove yourself to somebody or God. That's why resurrection isn't just about dying after you live. It's about living before you die. That's what he means to prompt in us. But in closing, my last point, the only way he can prompt that in us is unless he provides something for us. Brothers and sisters, he's done given us two things. He's given us a story of his dying and rising, which signals to us his forgiving and his embracing. What he would do for Lazarus, he would do for us by entering into the same experience that Lazarus did. He gave us that story. And when you think about just the story in John chapter 11, recognize this. Between Mary and Martha's question, if you had only been here, and Lazarus's resurrection, what they were being asked to do was wait and trust. They asked him to help. Lazarus dies. And then only later, Lazarus rises again. And in between those two moments, they were called upon to wait and trust. Trust that Jesus was who he said he was. Trust that his love was deeper than they knew. Trust that his power of resurrection was in himself. They had to trust that. And we have the luxury of knowing their whole story. If we could just sort of speak in their lives, we'd say to Mary and Martha, "Oh, just hold on a second. It's going to get really good." But when you think about it, brothers and sisters, we've now switched places with them. We live between two moments. We live in a story that we can't see the ending of. We live between a promise and a fulfillment. And now, just like they had to, we're having to learn to wait and trust with patience. And therefore, we've been invited to trust that he is good, that he is God, and that he will come through. He gave us that story that we might live with hope in ours. And he gave us a story in a very tangible form at this table. This meal summarizes that story. This meal is before the tears, it pictures the dying, and it sustains our faith in the rising. Brothers and sisters and honored guests, it's this table that means to shore up what he sought to prove. It's this table where he's out to strengthen what he's already sought to prompt in us. We're all going to be brought to our knees if we haven't already. We're all going to feel the anger and indignation of that ER doctor, and we're all going to feel the same longing that death's not going to prevail. But we have someone who went flatline, who was pronounced dead at about 3 o'clock on a Friday, whose death brought tears to men and women alike, but to the astonishment of everybody, he rose again. Brothers and sisters, what are you going to do when something brings you to your knees? You're going to go to that story, and you come to this table. And so if I might close with one poem that I said at the end of my father's funeral, also from George Herbert. Brothers and sisters, arise, arise, and with his burial linens dry thine eyes. Christ left his grave clothes behind so that we might, when death brings tears or blood, not want a handkerchief. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.